It's officially beach season, and people along the coasts are hitting the waves. But how safe is fun in the sun during a pandemic?
I don't want people to not enjoy their summers. I want people to fully enjoy it. But let's just kind of keep some of these things in check and balance it out against some of these other risks that we know are out there.
I'm Shamita Basu, in for Tanzina Vega. And for today on The Takeaway, Tuesday, May 26th, we take a look at how COVID-19 could affect our beach time. Also on the show, how Indonesia is handling the coronavirus pandemic.
What we are seeing is just a steadily growing upward, relentless curve. So it's becoming a real problem for this country.
Then why some medical professionals are running for political office.
I think that doctors are sort of rising to the challenge and really asking the question, why are our voices not being heard?
But first, to beach or not to beach? With Memorial Day weekend behind us and the warmer weather kicking into high gear, this would normally be the perfect time to start heading to the beach. And while public beaches are beginning to open in many coastal states, officials are putting a number of restrictions on these spaces due to the pandemic. In many areas, parking lots and public restrooms are closed, group sizes are limited, and stationary activities are discouraged. And while images of crowds swarming beaches have been singled out as evidence of the danger of keeping them open during a public health crisis, beaches are considered a fundamental part of so many communities. Take New York's Fire Island, which for decades has been a summer gathering place for LGBTQ people. Most businesses there are closed or only offering limited service, but local leaders are keeping the beaches open and encouraging visitors to enjoy them responsibly. But what exactly does responsible beach behavior look like during a pandemic?
What we're trying to encourage is that we continue to have a stance for observing physical distancing, masking as much as possible, hand hygiene as much as possible. Those are things that are difficult in the normal scene at a beach. So I think it's going to be abnormal times when people do go to the beach and try to do it in a socially responsible way.
That's Dr. Wilbur Chen, an adult infectious disease specialist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He's also a member of Maryland Governor Larry Hogan's COVID-19 Response Task Force. I spoke with him to get a sense of how to safely enjoy beaches and other public outdoor spaces this summer.
We've been cooped up with our own families for a period of weeks and months now. So it's perfectly reasonable to go to the beach with your family, throw the frisbee around, kick the ball around, play in the water. But then to introduce additional families, again, less is better. There may be different executive orders or policies and procedures that are in place. So from beach to beach, there may be a limitation in the group size. And over time, those might open up. So it might be 10 at first, or it might be 5 at first. Whatever it is, I certainly want the listener to adhere to those local guidelines and policies. But then again, just to be in the background, planning to be responsible, even if there is an allowance of 20 people, 20 people may not be the best, to try to always achieve the max numbers. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's what I want people to keep in mind, is try to balance out those activities with what you think really is necessary.
Are there different health concerns when you think about going to a public pool versus a public beach?
In instances, yes, there are, of course, at the community pool. It's another scene. It's a community meeting place. And so a lot of us bring our young children and they play together. And of course, we all have to use the shared facilities. Mm-hmm. So that's the shower, the toilet, the sinks, the snack bar. All of those are surfaces that we're all contacting. And that's very similar to the beach, actually. That's not really very different.
Right.
The pool, of course, the pool water is chlorinated. So I don't think that the pool water itself represents a risk. And so, again, we just have to be mindful that when we go to the pool, it's probably just a different attitude when we go to the pool, just as we have a different attitude to go to the beach. I'll also mention that there are lifeguards both at the pool and the beach. And the poor lifeguard, their job is to take on the risk of doing mouth-to-mouth and CPR for a person in distress. And so again, When you have more people that, again, are introducing that risk to that location, I don't know if those lifeguards are being compensated enough to take on this additional risk of knowing that they could get COVID. So I just want people to, again, let's think about this social responsibility. Am I doing this to my community for my own benefit? Am I doing it in a kind of public space where I'm being responsible personally and demonstrating that behavior? So let's just think about all of these attitudes and try to balance this out. I don't want people to not enjoy their summers. I want people to fully enjoy it. But let's just kind of keep some of these things in check and balance it out against some of these other risks that we know are out there.
Now, I mentioned earlier that you are on the COVID-19 Response Task Force in Maryland. And as I'm looking at responses in other states and how they're dealing with their beaches, it does seem like there is a bit of a patchwork. How much does that start to complicate the work of public health officials?
Yeah, it does make it more complicated. And again, honestly, there are some places in a particular state that might have a different burden of disease, which means that some parts of where I'm at in Maryland can open up earlier than other parts. We have a lot of burden of disease in the central corridor of Maryland, and so mm-hmm. we're not ready to open up there. But in Western Maryland, where it's mountainous, and then on the Eastern Shore, where we have the ocean, you know, they have low rates, so they can open up faster than we can here in the central corridor. So some of the worry and concern is that we'll have transmission just by introduction of people coming from outerlying either states or counties into the, you know, other counties that have low incidence. So for example, you know, some people might have their summer cottages in the mountains or at the beach. And again, I'm hearing from some of the local governments and officials, you know, we don't want people to come in and bring these infections, because we don't have a lot of hospitals here. We don't have a lot of beds. We don't have ICUs. And so to bring that in, you know, brings it another concern for the ability to deliver adequate medical care to their local community. And it makes it harder for them, honestly. So, you know, the governor has to kind of negotiate all of this, and it's his authority to govern from the state level. But, you know, local governments have the authority to govern over their jurisdictions as well. So, you know, we don't want to pit government against government, local against state or otherwise. We want to be thoughtful and work together.
Dr. Wilbur Chen is an adult infectious disease specialist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Thank you very much, Dr. Chen.
It was my pleasure.
We're going to stay at the beach just a little longer today and look at Florida and California, where beach culture is seen as an essential part of life, and efforts to limit access to beaches have been criticized by many residents and county officials. My next two guests have been closely following how beach openings are going in their respective states. Patricia Mazay is the Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Thank you for being here, Patricia.
My pleasure.
And Rosanna Shaw is an environment reporter covering the California coast for the Los Angeles Times. Hi to you, Rosanna.
Hi, happy to be on.
So, Rosanna, what did beaches in California look like over Memorial Day weekend? What's closed? What's not?
Yeah, for the most part, folks have been good. And, you know, things got pretty intense for a while. But as of last weekend, every county along the California coast had at least partial reopenings. Some of the parking lots in Los Angeles County were still closed. But, mm-hmm. you know, there were some dramatic photos from places like Venice Beach and the boardwalk. But for the most part, you know, I was talking to local officials yesterday, and they said that the crowds were mostly under control and people really get it that you got to practice safe distancing while you're out on the beach. No umbrellas, no coolers, no mm-hmm. flopping on the sand with a bunch of friends. And, you know, the only thing I think police said, at least in LA County, was that they wished they saw more people wearing face masks when not in the water. But it was pretty good.
You said that things got pretty intense there for a while. What are you referring to?
Oh, I mean, yeah, beach access. I mean, it's been like 2 months of beach closures. But, you know, access in general is a very emotional issue in California. You know, for listeners who aren't in California, we have this pretty unique law that guarantees that all beaches are public. Access to the coast is a right. And I spend so much of my time usually writing about how this law, the Coastal Act, gets enforced, what government agencies are doing to make sure that everyone has equal access to the coast. You know, and now with COVID for the last couple of weeks, months, it's been like, okay, we're closing all beaches. People were getting ticketed for surfing rather than putting up a fence to make your own private beach. And that really just has upended everyone's relationship to the coast. So I think it was just a very emotional issue in California, especially, you know, at this time when everyone is starting to go to the coast more often. It's getting hotter inland. And yeah, this past weekend was just a really nice respite for a lot of folks.
And Patricia, you're in Florida. I understand that Miami saw a lot of rainfall over this Memorial Day weekend. What did the beaches look like in Florida?
Well, Miami and Fort Lauderdale are still the places where the beaches are closed. They're going to open on June 1st. So I think at least there was so much rain and the beaches were closed that right here at the state's southern end, it was sort of like, okay, well, the weather didn't cooperate anyway. But in the rest of the state, the beaches were opened with various levels of restrictions, in some cases, no restrictions. And the most crowded areas were, you know, the most populous areas. So in Tampa, they had to start closing parking lots after the authorities deemed them to be too full. In Daytona, they had big crowds, especially coming in from the Orlando area, and they said they saw maybe 10,000 people at the beach there on Saturday, which was regular Memorial Day numbers, not lower than usual, according to the police. And they said people were social distancing to an extent, but they acknowledged that they wish there had been more spacing between people. But the police also said, you know, we're not the social distancing police. We're not here to make sure people stay 6 feet away from each other. That's sort of a matter of personal responsibility. And they had had issues there earlier on during the reopening when they had limited beach access to exercise. So people could not lay down on a towel or bring their umbrella. And the beach safety patrol, which normally would be sort of welcoming people to the beach and sort of trying to keep them safe, had become this sort of social distancing entity where they would have to go to a group and say, you guys are lingering when you need to be exercising. And then as soon as the, you know, patrol moved on, the group would go back to lying down and not exercising. So they sort of gave up on that approach because they realized that it was just not enforceable. And that's really the reason why places like Miami and Fort Lauderdale have taken this long to open, because they have so much coastline and so many people that they said, we just can't enforce many rules. We are expecting rules to come down soon ahead of the June 1st opening, and masks might be part of those in Miami, but we'll see how enforceable that is, especially hearing from Rosanna's experience in California.
And Patricia, just briefly, in about 30 seconds, you know, Rosanna was saying how emotional this is for Californians. Is it similarly emotional for people in Florida?
Oh, absolutely. People who live here tend to have a beach that they consider their beach because it is where they go with their family on any break that they have. And sometimes you sort of just become, you forget that you're near the beach and you don't go that often. But for a lot of people, that is the one free respite that they have outdoors.
Rosanna, what has California Governor Gavin Newsom's position been on beaches? And how much has he clashed with localities?
Yeah, there was this one clash a couple weeks ago with one specific county, Orange County, and it was following a weekend. I think it was the first super warm weekend in Southern California in April, that, or it might have been May. But, you know, after seeing the photos, Governor Newsom said, okay, all beaches in Orange County has to be closed until every city submits a plan to my office outlining how exactly you plan on managing crowds. And, you know, that was, there was some pushback on that. A couple, I think at least one city sued on their rights over that. But, you know, within a week, every city had submitted plans and had been approved for partial reopenings. You know, and when I say partial reopenings, it means, you know, limited parking lots were opened, some hours, you know, in Laguna for a while, you can only go to the beach from like 6 a.m. to 11 a.m. And then during the middle of the day, you couldn't go, active recreation only. So no one could sit down, sunbathe. It was mostly for running and for surfing and for individual kind of active beach activities. But, you know, for the most part, I mean, the California coast is 1,200 miles long. That's from like Boston to Georgia. And there are a lot of different beach communities up and down the coast, some rural, some super urban, like Orange County and Los Angeles County. So the rules have been different depending on what's needed to prevent overcrowding. And for the most part, the governor's office and the Coastal Commission, which is the statewide agency that's usually in charge of regulating the coastline, have deferred to local officials on how to manage beaches. And I think the one big clash was the one between Governor Newsom and Orange County. And that was just because the localities were not really, they were looser, I guess, about crowd management. And so that's when the governor kind of put his foot down.
And Patricia, what about in Florida? How would you characterize Governor Ron DeSantis's approach to beach openings and working with localities?
His approach has been to let this be decided at the county and city level. There was never an order to close down all of the Florida beaches or any of them. When they closed, it was on a county by county basis. And usually, if a county didn't want to close, it was forced to eventually when its neighboring counties did, and they found an influx of people in the county that was still open. There were some internal debates within local governments. We saw, for example, in some emails that we obtained in St. John's County, which is where St. Augustine is, just south of Jacksonville, where the medical examiner had been urging the county administrator to please close down the beaches because the county had an unusually high coronavirus infection rate. And she was, turned away. The county administrator explained his reasons and said that we're not doing it, but then they eventually did because Jacksonville closed down its beaches and people were just going into St. Augustine. In Naples on the Gulf Coast, they had to briefly close the beaches after reopening them earlier this month because of the crowds, but they, you know, opened them up again. And in South Florida, which has seen the bulk of the brunt of the cases in the pandemic, it was never really in question that the counties were going to stay closed a little bit longer. And even Broward County, which is where Fort Lauderdale is, wanted to open sooner. But knowing that people from Miami might drive up to Fort Lauderdale, they decided to wait until when Miami made up its mind. And then finally, the Florida Keys have been avoiding having that influx from outsiders by having a roadblock where only residents can be in the Keys. And that's going to be lifted in June.
Yeah, and who stands to lose access if public facilities on beaches are closed or limited? Is it mostly residents, or how much is Florida thinking about tourism for this summer?
No, tourism is a big concern, especially in communities that rely on people coming down and like renting a house on the beach. You know, vacation rentals have been a real issue. They were prohibited during, you know, weeks and weeks during the pandemic. And finally, the governor said, you know, if you want to allow rentals in your county again, you have to send me a plan on how you're going to safely do that. And for example, in the panhandle along the Gulf Coast, where vacation rentals are key to the local tourism economy, they were quick to submit a joint plan. And part of the plan, for example, was that they would not rent to people who were coming from places that had a high incidence of the virus. So, for example, if you were coming from New York City, you were not going to be able to rent a house in Pensacola Beach.
And Rosanna, what about in California? If beach parking lots and even the public facilities of public bathrooms stay closed in California this summer, who will it impact the most?
Yeah, that is a great question. I mean, beach closures here have raised interesting equity issues. And, you know, most of the local jurisdictions that have been managing crowds, they've been managing crowds by limiting which parking lots are open and closing, keeping the bathrooms closed and all of the public facilities. And by doing that, what you're essentially doing is creating a situation where those who are fortunate enough to live walking or biking distance to the beach can still go and kind of plan for even like a 20-minute jog along the beach and then go back to your own home for the bathroom or not park. But, you know, those who live further inland, who are trapped in heat zones or by freeways or don't even live in nice enough neighborhoods to walk around, you know, the ones who literally plan an entire Saturday, you know, with the whole family and they pack the van or they take the bus all the way out there. And they're the ones that end up not getting any access to the beach during this time. And, you know, this is an issue that we talk about a lot in California. You know, whenever we talk about an access issue with a specific beach, a lot of the time it's nitpicking how many parking spots are available for that specific beach, because parking is such a part of the access component when we talk about allowing folks who don't live by the coast to access the coast. Mm-hmm. So that's been a really challenging issue that I've seen a lot up and down the coast.
Patricia Mazet is the Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and Rosanna Shaw is an environment reporter covering the California coast for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Over the last couple of months, we've been checking in with communities across continents about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting life. Now we head over to Indonesia, where the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 has been steadily growing, while cases in other parts of Southeast Asia have been decreasing. We should note, though, that compared to its population size, the percentage of cases in Indonesia isn't like what we're seeing in the United States. But a sharp increase could overwhelm the developing nation, one of the largest countries in the world. Today, Indonesia reported new daily highs of coronavirus cases, and earlier in the month, the government banned domestic travel during one of the largest Muslim holidays of the year, Eid al-Fitr, that just passed this weekend. We go to Tom Allard, the Reuters chief correspondent in Southeast Asia, who lives in Indonesia's capital, Jakarta, to hear more. Hi, Tom, and welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Shamita.
Now, why has there been a rise in new coronavirus cases in Indonesia?
Well, look, Indonesia has got a kind of unique corona infection profile, really. At the outset, the government was extremely confident that they wouldn't have a problem. They were betting on the hot weather. They were betting on prayer. The health minister spoke very highly of the impact of prayer. So they were very slow mm-hmm. to, develop the kind of social distancing responses and other measures that we've seen elsewhere in the world. But maybe the prayers worked to an extent, in that it seems that we haven't seen, as you said in your intro, the kind of explosive growth that we've seen in the US, and perhaps mm-hmm. the hot weather is part of that, right? But what we are seeing is just a steadily growing upward, relentless curve. So they are, it's becoming a real problem for this country because, they don't have the money, they don't have the hospital system to cope with a major outbreak. And already, because of the somewhat belated measures to restrict travel, to implement social distancing, so many people have lost their jobs. We're talking about 30% of people were on social welfare. Now it's 70%. So the government said, we're going to run out of money at the end of July and we can't continue. So they've got a real dilemma here because they want to kickstart the economy, but at the same time, the coronavirus infection rate just keeps rising.
Are there concerns that the Indonesian government isn't telling the truth about the virus or reporting cases accurately?
Yeah, it's a big problem. I mean, the president of Indonesia in mid-March rather frankly and quite amazingly said, look, we're withholding information from the public because we don't want to stir panic. And that, if you think about a public health crisis, is probably what you don't say, because it created a lot of anxiety and questions about what exactly the government is telling it. And to be sure, the government has been reluctant to provide some very critical data that the epidemiologists want here in terms of suspected cases, which are enormous, and the true number of deaths. And underlying this dilemma is that Indonesia has one of the lowest testing rates in the world. It's something mm-hmm. like 150 people per million have been tested thus far. So it's extremely low. So everyone is in the dark, and that's created a fair degree, as I said, of anxiety amongst the population.
Mm. Now, Tom, despite the recent rise in cases, the government opened up domestic travel after it had restricted it about 3 weeks ago. Why the reversal?
Well, I mean, simply put, they want to restart the economy, and they see this as a measure. The way that they're trying to, ameliorate the negative effects that would have on the coronavirus's spread is to force everyone to wear masks and to enforce social distancing and that type of thing. But, the jury is out, shall we say, whether that's going to be a successful strategy. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, it's Eid al-Fitri at the moment, and that's a great occasion for most Indonesians. It's the biggest Muslim country in the world, majority country in the world, and everyone returns home to their villages to celebrate this occasion with family and friends.
And that was just this past weekend, right? It was to mark the end of Ramadan.
That's right, and it literally finished yesterday, but... So the government ostensibly banned Mudik, but that was the official policy. But as you say, they began to open flights up, and basically a lot of people left anyway. And so despite all these pleading from the government to stay at home, to do video conferencing or whatever, to communicate with their families, a lot of people have returned home. And we've seen a lot of images of huge crowds gathering to pray together, to chant Allahu Akbar. And the fear is that down the line in the next couple of weeks is going to lead to another surge in coronavirus infections. Mm.
Earlier, you alluded to Indonesia's healthcare system not being well equipped to handle a surge in new cases. Can you describe a little bit how the healthcare system there works?
Yeah, well, look, it's never been a priority for the Indonesian government. They've begun to throw a lot of money into infrastructure, to a lesser extent education, but health has always been down the bottom of the leaderboard, so to speak. So you're talking about 4 hospital beds per 10,000 people in Indonesia is the kind of ratio. That's probably 10 times less than most developed countries in the world. So if the coronavirus rate of infection continues to climb, you're going to find a lot of that the hospitals will become quickly overwhelmed. I mean, we're talking here, it's a country of 270 million people. They have 8,000 ventilators. Mm. And that includes ventilators for, premature babies, which I'm not sure can be readily utilised for adult coronavirus infection sufferers. So they're in a very precarious state should the infection rate continue to climb. I mean, there's all sorts of measures. They are trying to build their own ventilators for coronavirus sufferers. And that's being mobilised. So maybe that will come to the rescue. And thankfully, given that it has been a relatively slow, steady climb, that probably gives the government a bit more breathing space to get all that into gear. But we shall see. But the other problem is, as I said, with all these people returning to their villages, this was a pandemic or an epidemic that started in the capital city, Jakarta, but it has quickly spread to every corner of Indonesia. So there are infections in every province, in most regencies. So it's in those outlying areas where the hospital system is particularly weak and particularly vulnerable should things get worse.
Mm. Tom Allard is the Reuters chief correspondent in Southeast Asia. Tom, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Shamita.
COVID-19 has given us all a newfound appreciation for healthcare workers. Across the country, people hold nightly cheers, and on social media, healthcare workers are held up as heroes. But could that kind of enthusiasm translate into votes? For 2 doctors in Oregon, it already has. Dr. Maxine Dexter won her primary for State House Representative in District 33. And this is Dr. Lisa Reynolds, who claimed victory in District 36.
One of the reasons I think I won this race is because others agreed that this is an important time to have politicians who have a deep background in healthcare, in virology, and in vaccine science. The acknowledgement that we need physicians and scientists during this unprecedented time in our history really won the day.
To find out more about how having healthcare workers in office might be beneficial during the current pandemic, I spoke with Dr. Christine Edie Mann, a family practice physician in Cedar Park, Texas, and a congressional candidate in Texas District 31. I also spoke with Dr. Haisam Gwaili, a family medicine doctor and psychiatrist, and the founder of Doctors in Politics, an organization that supports doctors running for Congress. I first asked Dr. Edie Mann about her experience treating patients with COVID-19 in Texas.
It started out very disconcerting. The federal response to this pandemic was so disjointed that we on the ground really had no great direction about what we should be doing and how we should be handling these questions and these cases as they came in. Mm-hmm. And so we were left struggling to have a algorithm and a method for taking care of people and answering questions. And that lasted for several weeks. And then we started seeing people coming in for testing. And now we just kind of roll with the punches as things change and take care of people as they need to be taken care of.
And I understand that you decided to run for Congress in Texas before this pandemic. But how has living and working through this experience changed the stakes for you?
It's really been a motivator to complete this campaign and win because the COVID-19 experience is exposing the terrible disparities we have in healthcare, the holes that we have in people being able to access the care that they need, and underrepresented communities are disproportionately being affected. And we've mm-hmm. known that about medicine in general, but this just highlights how bad and how profound it really is.
And Haisam, what about for you? You're working in a psychiatric ward in New York, I understand. What have the past few months been like for you?
Yeah, I think it's been a real struggle. Over the past couple of months, we've really seen mental health issues amplified in the midst of this pandemic. I think what we're seeing now is a general level of anxiety across the population. We're seeing an increase in suicidality, and patients are coming into the hospital a lot sicker.
I want to know both of your thoughts on this, but maybe Christine, can you start? What policy change would make your work during this pandemic better or more effective?
The first thing is that we need universal access to healthcare. We have a situation right now where millions of Americans do not have access to the care that they need. We know that that's been that way forever. And so the number one policy change would be to ensure that every American has access to healthcare from birth to death without exceptions for job loss or for pre-existing conditions or for any other reason. So that's what I've been fighting for about 12 years. I started speaking out about that long before I was a candidate for Congress, but it is one of my main platform positions as I go through this cycle.
And Haisam, what about for you in your work that you're doing right now? Have you been thinking about what structural policy changes would actually make a big difference in how you're able to deliver your services?
Yeah, I think that we need to be having the conversation about healthcare and not health insurance. And we really need to create a system that has nothing to do with the business of medicine, but focuses on being devoted to patients and restoring the human factor of medicine that's sort of been eroded over the past several years.
Christine, what is the value, do you think, of having doctors serving in these elected roles?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, just from the policy writing piece of it, there's no substitute for decades of experience in medicine when it comes to helping others in Congress and in legislative bodies to understand the healthcare system. My experiences through the years of practice can't be duplicated by just a booklet that a campaign aide or a legislative aide puts together for you when you are going into these negotiations. Mm-hmm. So bringing that firsthand experience is critical and crucial. And I think the other thing is that we are seeing more and more doctors who are not only cognizant of social determinants of health, but who are recognizing that politics impacts those social determinants of health. And right now, it's to the detriment of our patients. And it is giving us a voice to say, gun laws affect our patients. Mm-hmm. Healthcare policy affects our patients. Disparities between mental health and physical health affect our patients. Systemic racism affects our patients. All of these social determinants of health impact our practices, and we are at the point more and more where we're saying we want to do something about that.
You know, a couple of years ago, I'm recalling when the National Rifle Association spoke out, and this was sometime after a major mass shooting, and a number of doctors and medical professionals had been speaking out and saying that it was time to introduce some gun legislation. And the National Rifle Association said at the time that those anti-gun doctors should, quote, stay in their lane, or in other words, stay politically neutral, stick to what they know, stick to medicine. And I remember a lot of doctors pushed back against that. Haisam, do you feel the pressure to leave politics out of your work?
Yeah, I think there's always a pressure in our training to remain as apolitical as possible. But I think what we're learning is that healthcare isn't just about delivering healthcare now. It's also about economics and politics. People are making political decisions that directly impact our interactions with patients in the room. We are seeing the effects of legislation on people and how they have to navigate their lives to try to live a life of dignity and quality, despite people not really understanding how the laws are impacting them. I think that there is really this huge push, right, for doctors to get involved, to get political, to flip the narrative so that we can actually do what's best for our patients, as opposed to the present system.
Haisam, I understand that you ran for city council in Seattle in 2017, and now, of course, you're helping others who want to run for office through your organization, Doctors in Politics. Have you seen more of an interest and an urgency among medical doctors in entering politics since the pandemic began?
Yeah, I think that there truly is an urgency now for doctors to be at the table. I think what is really clear is that the leadership that is coming from the government and from medical bodies that are supposed to represent us and hospital organizations are just not putting people first. And that disconnect is really leading to poor outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so I think that doctors are sort of rising to the challenge and really asking the question is, why are our voices not being heard? And since we are experts in this field, can look at data and make decisions, we should actively be involved in how healthcare is restructured in this country.
In 2018, we did see this wave of women candidates running for office across the country. We saw a wave of candidates coming from STEM fields with non-political backgrounds for the most part. How do you think these candidates from medical backgrounds might fare in the polls this November?
Yeah, I think that we saw really a surge of women and STEM candidates in 2018, and I think appropriately so. I think that the American people want something different. They want people who represent them and care about their vested interests. I think that our candidates that are running in 2020, they have come from very different backgrounds and are all really interested in pushing a narrative of putting patients first and restoring the human factor of medicine back into healthcare.
And I will tell you that we had two doctors won their Democratic primaries in Oregon. So I think that just speaks to the idea that doctors are respected members of the community. And I think that this is a group of people who is untapped and has a great potential for making a difference in a legislative body.
Haisam, maybe you can talk about this. How do you think doctors as elected officials would maybe help message to the public and bridge sort of a gap of understanding? I'm thinking that part of what some people in this country might be struggling with right now in terms of this pandemic is understanding the scientific information around COVID-19. What do you think might change if there were more doctors in elected roles?
I think that what we are seeing is that they're really good at messaging complicated ideas in simple terms so that patients can understand it. We do it every day when we talk about chronic illnesses that people suffer from, and this is no different. I think that we as doctors can take complicated legislation, explain it to people in a meaningful way so that it is digestible and understandable. And so I really think that doctors have a very unique perspective. We are not paid to be adversarial. We are collaborative in our natures. And so I think that is really a strength that Congress is really lacking at this time.
Christine, I wonder what your thoughts are on how you've watched the relationship and dynamic play out between Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's the head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, and the president himself, President Trump. What has watching that relationship made you think about doctors and medical professionals and politicians?
It has been a yo-yo between being so thankful that he is there to push back against some of the narratives that the president is putting out there versus days where I just want to yell because he's not pushing back as vigorously as I would hope that he would. And quite frankly, I feel like he is walking a tightrope as best he can, that he recognizes that his voice at that level is 100% necessary, that there is no one else who is going to do what he is doing, and that he is doing everything he can to keep this ship going in some fashion in the correct direction, knowing that the president is going to override him at every turn. It is an opportunity, though, for someone to at least be speaking out when he's able to against some of the things and the theories and the false information that the president is giving.
And how do you yourself think about having to potentially walk those kinds of lines and make those political decisions and those political messaging sorts of decisions? And do you see them as being in opposition or in conflict with some of your training and your medical background?
I would only be in conflict with my medical background and my training if I didn't speak the truth and if I didn't speak using evidence. And I am not worried about that conflict at all. As Haisam was mentioning earlier, we have a daily job where we have to convince people to do things that they may not agree with, that they may not think is correct, that they don't understand what the importance is. And my job as a doctor is to convince people to do things that they don't want to do. And that is a skill set that I have honed over 20 years. And I'm ready to use that same skill set to convince people who do not agree with me legislatively about why they should do what I'm asking them to do.
In 2018, the Trump administration disbanded the pandemic response team. And some critics have said that that's part of the reason why we are not as well prepared as we should be for this current crisis. Christine, what do you think needs to change for the U.S. to be more prepared for a crisis like this in the future?
Well, there's no question that the pandemic response team needs to be put back together. It will help us some with this current crisis, although we are so far down the road right now that we are going to have a real challenge in managing how this pandemic plays out. But there is no question that we should have scientific experts available. And what a lot of people don't understand about pandemic response teams is that their work is ongoing. They continuously search their colleagues, their connections throughout the world for issues that may break out into the public, disease hotspots, and they game out how to address those issues. They make sure that we have stockpiles of necessary medical supplies. They understand how to move those supplies from location to location within the United States. This is not a passive team that only jumps into action when there is an actual crisis. They are constantly working to make sure that we are prepared. And the idea that that response team was disbanded in 2018 is just abhorrent, and it needs to be fixed.
Dr. Christine Edie Mann is a family practice physician in Cedar Park, Texas, and she's a congressional candidate in Texas District 31. And Dr. Haisam Gwaili is a family medicine doctor and a psychiatrist and the founder of Doctors in Politics. Thank you both of you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And coming back to our top story on beaches, we want to hear from you. If you were at the beach this weekend, tell us what it was like. Was it hard to follow new guidelines? 8778-MY-TAKE is our number, or you can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also tweet at me. I'm at ShuBasu, S-H-U-B-A-S-U. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Shamita Basu, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.